Good day, everyone, and welcome to Detroit Today on 101.9 WDET. I'm Stephen Henderson, your host, and I'm really glad you've decided to join us. There's a pretty fundamental idea in this country around the concept that if you work hard and get educated, well, you'll be successful. Lots of people believe in this and work at it every day. There is this notion, very American, that if you put in enough time, energy, and effort to the thing you're trying to accomplish, well, you'll achieve it. But that broad idea hides many other truths about life in this country. Over the last 50 years in particular, inequality has grown as our economy has changed to favor those at the top far more, and as costs for things like education and healthcare and housing have skyrocketed, yanking away from folks at the bottom of the economic ladder the opportunities to move up. The nation's fundamental inequalities, gathered around the racism that has been baked into the system from the jump, is a constant aggravator of those economic trends. And this toxic brew has left America, which is the richest country in the world, with an awful lot of people who live in poverty. In fact, recent data tell us that about 5% of Americans live in what's called deep poverty, which means they make only $13,000 annually for a family of four. According to Princeton sociologist Matthew Desmond, an author of a new book titled Poverty by America, these numbers don't even tell us the full story of poverty in our country. That there are many people who aren't necessarily counted as poor, but are still really struggling to get by. And that's because poverty is about more than just numbers. It's a lived struggle, a cognitive terror similar to not getting enough sleep. It's the loss of liberty for so many poor folks who are incarcerated in jails and prisons. And of course, poverty is also embarrassing. Many consider it a sin or a disease, as if it can be caught like an infection. Why do we still have so much poverty in America? What's causing it, especially as our federal government spends more and more on anti-poverty programs? And what do we need to do in order to end poverty in America? Or at least end the deep intergenerational poverty that has taken hold of so much of our country. That's where we begin the conversation today. And we've got Matthew Desmond here with us. I want to say before I introduce him that he has been a guest on the show before, several years ago, after his first book, Evicted, came out. He was the featured author in our summer book club here on WDET. So, Matthew, welcome back to Detroit Today.
Thanks, Stephen. It's great to be back.
Yeah. So I want to start here. You lost your home as a child growing up in Arizona. I want to have you talk just a little about that experience and how it shaped your understanding of poverty and hardship in America early on.
We did. You know, I grew up in a home that didn't have a lot of money. We often got our gas shut off. And when I was in college, we lost our home to foreclosure after my parents declared bankruptcy. And I experienced that shock, like a lot of folks who were struggling experienced their own shocks with embarrassment. I blame my parents. I blame my family. It was a personal narrative for me. And I think that getting older and becoming a sociologist, part of my job is to kind of turn personal problems into political ones, to quote C. Wright Mills, to say, look, you know, yeah, you guys win something through something, but you're not the only ones. And there's a bigger game afoot other than individual decisions. And so I think that, you know, seeing how my family was pressed and stretched by our poverty really drove this question about why inside of me, why all this suffering amidst all this abundance.
And as I said in the open, I think one of the really powerful points you're making in this new book is that the numbers we use to quantify the problems that we have with poverty in America in some ways really obscure the reality of what it looks like and what it feels like and what the effect of it is on people's lives. I want to talk just a little about what you make of the way we measure poverty in this country and how we might have a different line or barometer for defining it.
We measure poverty as an income level. You know, if you fall below a certain income, you're considered poor. But that's not even close to scratching the surface. You know, there's plenty of poverty above the poverty line, so to speak. One in three of us live in households bringing in $55,000 or less. Now, many of those families are considered poor, but what else do you call trying to raise 2-3 kids, you know, in Ann Arbor or Milwaukee or Chicago on 55K or less? You call it struggling. And I think that poverty isn't just the lack of income. It's this constellation of problems. It's eviction on top of homelessness, on top of depression, on top of you can't go to the dentist, so you just let the tooth rot, on top of get roughed up by the police, on and on it goes. So it's not a line, right? It's this kind of tight knot of social humiliations and problems. And I think that that means that millions and millions of us are denied security and safety and dignity in a land of dollars. And I think that this is a situation we don't have to tolerate.
So in your first book, Evicted, you explored the way that eviction operates, both how landlords operate and what losing your home does to people. I wonder if you can talk just a little about the relationship between the things you learned in Milwaukee, which was the setting for that book, and this new book about more general poverty. What's the link there?
I think the link was I saw a kind of poverty in Milwaukee that I had never seen before and never experienced before. You know, I saw grandmas living without heat in the winter in mobile home parks, you know, piled under blankets and praying that the space heaters didn't go out. I saw kids evicted on a routine basis. You know, every time I went to eviction court, there were just tons and tons of kids running around. And I think seeing that level of poverty, that level of this hard bottom of deprivation really motivated me to kind of present a story about why there is so much poverty in the richest country on the planet.
I want to talk about the spending that we do on anti-poverty programs and what you make of it. But I also want to couch that in some of the things that people are saying about poverty. You argue in the book that poverty has stagnated over time, but there are a lot of people who are saying it's going down and that it has gone down with regards to absolute poverty. People are talking about expanded tax credits and Medicaid, Social Security, all kinds of things that they say are making this problem less of a problem than it was in the past. Talk about anti-poverty programs and whether you agree that they are helping to solve this problem.
Anti-poverty programs are essential. They are effective. There is a mountain of evidence showing that programs like Medicaid, unemployment insurance, food stamps, housing assistance, these are lifesavers to millions and millions of families. I've been with people when they've received housing vouchers after years and years on the waiting list, and they often drop to their knees and pray, you know, because they know it's life-changing. And the evidence has their back. So we have to protect and deepen our investments in programs that work. And we also have to face the fact that those programs aren't enough. And, you know, measuring poverty is hard. We got to confront that question with a lot of humility. But even if you use certain measures of poverty that account for increases of government aid, you see that poverty has been very stubborn over the decades. You know, there's a measure called the supplemental poverty measure that does account for different kind of government programs, but it also accounts for cost of living and rising healthcare costs. You know, 50 years ago in 1973, that measure said we had 15.1% poverty in America. 40 years later, it was 15.5. Not a lot of action. And if you look at just hardship measures, like what's happening with evictions since 2000, up 22%. Mm. What's happening with the share of families visiting food pantries to feed their kids, up 19% since 2000. Number of homeless school kids, up 74% since the Great Recession. These are pretty troubling signs in America. And so I think this is the paradox we have to kind of lean into if we want to abolish poverty. Government programs work. They're essential. And yet poverty persists. And the reason it does is some of the fundamentals of American society are breaking down. We haven't addressed exploitation, especially in the housing market and the labor markets.
Hmm. We're talking with Matthew Desmond. He is a sociology professor at Princeton University, is author of the widely acclaimed and Pulitzer Prize winning book, Evicted. He's got a new book out titled Poverty by America. It takes a look at what the experience of poverty is really like for people who struggle with it, also pushes us to think more broadly about what poverty is, how we define it, as a way of really thinking more broadly about how we eliminate it. What kinds of things do we need to do differently to make sure that there is more opportunity and less poverty? We'd love to hear from you during the conversation as well. Call and tell us if you've had an experience with poverty, what that has been like, what is it like day to day, what is it like over time, what do you think we should be doing to address poverty and reduce or eliminate it? Why do you think America has so much poverty, given that it is the richest nation on the planet? As always, the number here on the phones is 313-577-1019. That's 313-577-1019. You can also go to Twitter and hashtag Detroit Today, and we can include you in the conversation that way. Matthew, I want to talk about some of the specific experiences of poverty that you outline in the book. Tell the story of Julio Paez. What did poverty look and feel like for him?
Julio was a young man who was working two jobs when I met him. He would clock in at McDonald's and work the midnight shift, going from 10 p.m. to 6 a.m. Then he'd have 2 hours to rest and shower, and then he went to Aerotech, was a temp service, and went anywhere that they sent him from 8 a.m. to 4 p.m. And then he rested as much as he could, and then it was back to McDonald's. Each job paid minimum wage. But Julio told me, like, look, I got to work this much to afford the apartment for my mom and my brother. And he didn't have a life, right? He was either working or sleeping. And one day, his little brother, Alexander, who was 8 at the time, went up to Julio and was like, you know, I'm saving my money. And Julio was like, why? And he's like, well, how much for an hour to play with me? I'm saving it. I want to buy an hour of your time, you know? And when Julio heard that, he wept. And not long after that happened, he collapsed in the aisle of a grocery store from just sheer exhaustion. He was 24 years old. Mm. So what do we, you know, what do we steal from folks like Julio when we keep wages low? We steal their life and their health and their family.
That human cost is, of course, a theme that comes up over and over in the book. It's really tough, of course, to be poor. But you talk about something called the bandwidth tax, the type of cognitive load that being poor means for so many to have to deal with. Explain more about what you mean by that term, bandwidth tax.
The bandwidth tax comes from a pile of social, psychological, and behavioral economic research. And it's summarized in a beautiful book called Scarcity, which is a book about how poverty taxes the mind. And the bandwidth tax is something I think a lot of us can relate to. We've all been in situations that are emergency-like situations, you know, where we're in the hospital waiting room. We can't think about anything other than that person on the operating table, or we're late to work. You know, we slept in and we're racing to a job interview, something like that. When we're in those situations, we tend not to be our best selves. You know, that situation captures the mind. It gives us literally less space to think. And a lot of research has shown that's what poverty's like. You know, when you are facing down eviction, or your lights are going to get shut off, or your kid's getting bullied at school or has to be held back a grade, or your neighborhood just isn't safe, or, you know, you're getting sexually harassed at work. On and on that goes. The experience of poverty taxes the mind. And it's really unjust, I think, for those of us that are perched much further above the economic ladder than poverty, to kind of demand a kind of, you know, superhuman activity and thinking that can only come when that bandwidth tax is relaxed, you know, when we have some slack in our life. Mm. So I think thinking about the bandwidth tax is thinking about like the experiences of poverty. And for those of us that are not poor, really trying to put ourselves in the shoes of those who are.
Yeah. In the book, you talk also about this relentless piling on of problems through the story of Crystal. Tell our listeners about her struggles.
Crystal was a woman I met when I did my last book, Evicted, in Milwaukee. When we met, she was 18, and you know, she was born on a cold spring day when her mom was stabbed in the back and the attack induced labor. And that start for Crystal's life kind of came to characterize her life, you know. Her parents were in a domestic violence relationship. At five, she was placed in foster care. She bounced around foster homes. She lived with her aunt for 5 years. Then her aunt returned her. And the longest she lived after that was, I think, 8 months. You know, when she was 16, she dropped out of high school. When she was 18, she aged out of foster care. And she had collected an assault charge for fighting with girls in the group home, so she couldn't get housing assistance. And so she got her first apartment in a really poor neighborhood, but it still took 73% of her income. She soon got evicted. And she's just 18, right? I'm telling you all this stuff.
Before,
and she's just a kid, yeah. Really, still.
Wow.
And so I think that, you know, I think that looking really hard at Crystal's life not only helps us feel the weight of poverty, but I hope should spur us to moral action. You know, poverty isn't just a necessary part of post-industrial capitalism. It should be seen as abomination, something that we want to abolish.
So I want to talk a little about why poverty persists in our country and just kind of throw out some theories. I mean, one way of thinking of it is because the pain of poverty is one of the points of capitalism, that the system, the economic system that we have, needs to have people who occupy this space of lack of opportunity and disinvestment. And in some ways, culturally, we want there to be some people who are poor. I guess another theory is that we believe that using our resources to try to help people get to different spaces will just be a drain on the system and create a dependency for them. I wonder what you make of why we continue to struggle with this and why we can't make decisions that would create better opportunities, that would alleviate some of these things that you detail so wonderfully in the book.
When you read the early capitalists, they think that this system is going to abolish poverty in the world. Mm-hmm. You know, they John Stuart Mill famously said, you know, if this causes widespread deprivation, I'm going to be a communist. You know, this was a champion of free markets. The capitalism we have in America, it's unique. It's a uniquely low-road capitalism. And you can go to capitalist countries overseas and you can see a lot less poverty than we have here. So there's nothing inherent about capitalism that demands or requires all this poverty and the kind of desperate, hard poverty that we tolerate in America. And you can see this with other capitalist countries that just make deeper investments in their people. And speaking of welfare dependence and that those deeper investments, you know, if you look at the data, there's very little evidence of welfare dependency, actually. And there's been very little evidence for a long, long time. What there is evidence of is welfare avoidance. You know, folks not getting connected to programs that they really need and that are designed for them. You know, most elderly Americans who qualify for food stamps don't take them, don't use them. One in five workers who qualify for the Earned Income Tax Credit, which is this once-a-year bump for our poorest-paid workers, they don't take that, you know, and on it goes. And, you know, by my calculation, you know, we're leaving over $140 billion every year in unused aid because, you know, families aren't getting connected to these programs. This is not a picture of welfare dependency, right? This is a picture of us doing a terrible job of getting that aid out the door. So, Stephen, why is there so much poverty, right? And my answer is because of a lot of us benefit from it. A lot of us benefit from it. You know, some lives are made small so that others may grow. And I, you know, I quote this line in the book by Tommy Orange, the novelist, where he writes, you know, it's like these kids are jumping out of the windows of burning buildings, falling to their deaths. And we think that the problem is that they're jumping.
Not that the building is on fire.
Right. So this is a book about the fire. You know, this is a book about who said it and who's warming their hands by it.
Yeah. Okay. Matthew Desmond, professor of sociology at Princeton University and author of the book Poverty by America. It was really great to have you back here with us on Detroit Today. Thanks so much for joining and congratulations on the book.
Thank you, Stephen. It's always an honor to speak with you.
When we come back, we are going to continue talking about poverty. I'm going to shift the focus just a little bit and talk with Mona Hannah Atisha. She is a pediatrician at Michigan State University, known for bringing attention to the Flint water crisis. She is going to talk to us about a new anti-poverty program that's taking place in Flint that she is heading up. We also want to continue to hear from you on the phones and on social. 313-577-1019 is the number. Call and tell us about your experiences with poverty. Tell us about your ideas to solve poverty. What kinds of things do you think we could be doing that we seem unable or unwilling to do? You can also go to Twitter and hashtag Detroit Today, and you can be part of the program that way. We'll be right back with more Detroit Today.